This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, the healthcare.gov debacle deepens as millions of Americans discover their pre-Obamacare insurance plans are being canceled. Also, is it okay for a New York department store to practice racial profiling? I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, Romeo and Juliet is on Broadway and in the multiplex. Wherefore this glut of star-crossed lovers? Then, if you thought internet memes were just new ways to waste time, maybe they're really a form of conceptual art. And then, the death this week of a true rock and roll pioneer, Lou Reed. We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. If you like your current insurance, you can keep it, or maybe not. The latest twist in the healthcare.gov fiasco. And then the racial profiling controversy that's causing a mess for two New York department stores. Joining me in Washington today is Slate Chief Political Correspondent John Dickerson. Hello, John.
Hello, David.
And from New Haven, Slate Senior Editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
The ongoing fiasco of healthcare.gov continued and metastasized this week as the president vowed to have the healthcare marketplace working by the end of November and touted the likely benefits of the plan. The administration was being besieged in several directions. Kathleen Sebelius, the secretary of HHS, and other top officials were summoned before Congress to do penance about how they messed up the website. Americans on certain plans began receiving cancellation notices despite President Obama's promise during the campaign, was it, John, or later? During the rollout?
Well, during the rollout and after.
During the rollout,
he promised repeatedly
that if you like your plan, you can keep it. But now plans are being canceled. The administration, will they have an answer for that? We'll talk about their answer in a minute. Also, the site crashed again this weekend, by the way. Although it seems to be back up, sort of.
Yeah.
Kind of. I loved yesterday you did a great GabFest Extra with David Auerbach, a software engineer who's been writing for us about this. And I was so fascinated to learn all about his sense about what the serious bugs were and what weren't and where the problems were. I strongly commend anyone to listen to that.
Yeah, he was just great. He was really great.
Let's talk about this issue of people's plans getting canceled. So the president had said, if you like your plan, you can keep it. Now it appears that people are getting cancellation notices, Emily, from their insurers. Mostly these are people who are not on employee plans, are also not on Medicaid or Medicare. They're getting cancellation notices from their insurers saying that because of Obamacare, we're canceling your plan, meaning you're going to have to go sign up for a new individual plan in the healthcare exchanges. Of course, you're unable to do that right now. The Republicans and in fact, many Democrats are saying, hey, Obama, you promised that we could keep our plans. Now we can't. What's the deal? Do you think the president has a legitimate response here, Emily?
Well, I mean, their response is that he was talking about people who are on employer-based plans. And what we're now focusing on are the 5% people who are on individual plans. And the reason they can't keep their individual plans is that they're bad plans, according to the administration, that don't provide enough coverage and are too expensive. And so under the new rules of Obamacare, they will be eligible for better coverage. Okay, but the storytelling and theater of this is terrible because instead of people feeling like, oh, good, I'm happily switched over to this better plan. Who needs this old bad pair of shoes I was wearing? It's like they're being left barefoot in the desert with all this worry that this website is never going to work. And the whole thing just seems so wobbly that I think that is focusing a lot of attention on these people with individual plans. And if I was them, I would also feel worried and upset.
John, is Emily right that the president really doesn't have a good comeback here?
He has an okay comeback absent the context. So the reason he said for 4 years that if you have your plan, it won't change, is that he was trying to sell people on what was going to be a disruptive change to the healthcare market. And the biggest political challenge he had was that people who had existing plans through their employers, the 80% of the population, were terrified that whatever he was going to do was going to destroy what they had and what they liked. So he was promising a kind of controlled chaos. He was promising to change the status quo, which was terrible. People, even who had insurance, were getting bankruptcies as a result of going into the hospital and having more costs than they were expecting. And he was saying, I'm going to change dramatically the healthcare system, but only in this very narrow and controlled way. And that's what this promise was all about. It was the central promise because it was basically saying, I will do something, but it will be a controlled business. And in that context, then now, when you say, well, for this 5% of the population, for these 11 million or so people, it's not really true that they're going to be able to keep their doctor, but what they're going to get is going to be better. And even though in some cases what they get isn't necessarily going to be better, what starts to happen is you get into the kind of dissembling that, compared to the original way he talked about this, the ironclad, nothing's going to change, there's obviously a disconnect there. And since what he's in the middle of, and as in some ways always been a part of the Affordable Health Care Act, has been a credibility question. Are the promises he's making going to actually turn out to be true? And as the website has its issues, which is in a sense a credibility problem, we said it was going to work like this and now it's not working like that. It adds to this feeling that the law is not as it was advertised, and therefore it reignites the initial worry among people who are not even affected by the Affordable Care Act directly, and that's everybody who has regular insurance thinking, geez, I was promised all these things about how it wasn't going to screw up my health care. Now these promises are not turning out to be true, and that just makes people worried.
So someone made this point. I wrote it down in my notes, but I didn't write down who made it, so whoever made it, good job. The healthcare narrative for the past, really for the past 20 years practically, has been a story in which some poor person, the exemplar story has been about some poor person, a sick person, cannot get insurance because of horrible HMOs, because of laws about pre-existing conditions, whatever, and getting screwed. Now we have, that was a narrative that really favored the Democratic story on healthcare
and people
reform.
Were going bankrupt and suffering.
And going bankrupt
mightily.
And suffering. And now the narrative has been flipped, which is because of this overregulation, because of the octopus of Obamacare, which is putting its horrible greasy tentacles into every aspect of American insurance life. It's poor, innocent, you know, do-gooding citizens who've had insurance are getting crushed by this horror in Washington by Sebelius and Obama. And that's a narrative, obviously, which aligns with what the Republicans have been saying.
I mean, it's not really a true narrative in the long run if Obamacare works the way it's supposed to, because what happens to people who are on plans with huge copayments and bad coverage is they get better plans. And other people's insurance premiums go up because the insurance companies can't reject sick people anymore and you're spreading risk. And so it is true that young, healthy people will be paying somewhat more, but that's a good thing overall. It's just we haven't seen any of that actually materialize yet.
But I think the most controlling story in healthcare is still the one that affects the people, the largest number of people, which is all the people in the employer-based system. And those people are worried that what they have now, as imperfect as it may be, will get worse.
But, John, we don't have any real reason to feel that way, right? I mean, I understand the anxiety, but it's not like that something is happening to the employer-based healthcare plans that would make us rationally expect that, right?
I mean, what killed the Clintons' attempt to do this and then what made Obama's attempt to do it never really popular is that the huge group of people who were in the employer-based system said, once you start monkeying with it over here, to help these people who are, you know, not being covered because of pre-existing conditions, who are getting into plans where they're getting screwed, once you start helping them, you're going to mess with the whole system and that's going to slop over and affect me. And that's always been the political thing the president's been fighting against. And he's never really fixed that.
What I find so bizarre about all of this is that the Republican criticisms are 100% legitimate. They are absolutely been vindicated in the incompetence of the rollout. And yet there is so little willingness to offer any ideas, any alternatives. Because if you think about what Obamacare consists of, it consists of things which Republicans now all support. For example, the ban on pre-existing conditions, the being able to deny people insurance, that will never come back. You cannot bring that back. People with pre-existing conditions are going to be allowed to get insurance. Covering things like pregnancy and mental health, those are things which are going to be covered in the future. You cannot get rid of them. Basically, what it comes down to is how much are we going to subsidize the insurance for the people who are not super poor but moderately poor? That's the only thing that really is at issue now.
Well, but I feel like that's not totally true, because also what's at issue is whether this whole notion of an exchange, which is the private market operating in this government-constructed universe, whether that's going to succeed or not. And it seems like the evidence for some of the states that are actually having functional websites and the evidence from Massachusetts is that it can work perfectly fine, and then we will see these benefits. But nationally speaking, we don't have anything to show for that yet. And so that's the thing that seems to me rationally would be the problem that people could legitimately be fearing.
I don't really understand that, but maybe that's because I didn't understand what I just said.
Because it's this whole problem we were talking about last week, which I know you understand, that the only way for the exchange market to function is if lots of people sign up, some of them healthy who are lower cost, and spread risk.
Right.
I mean, it seems like that's still a question mark. If we see that working, then this basically market-oriented, you know, Heritage Foundation dreamed up solution to the problem of people with moderate incomes having no health insurance, then we'll know that can work. But until we see that, that is this big question that is unresolved. Right, John? Am I crazy?
Yeah. That's the policy danger for the Obama administration at the heart of the healthcare website not working. Under what they had hoped, the healthcare website would be there. People would be able to comparison shop. They would get these letters from their insurers saying you're losing your insurance. And they'd say, well, that doesn't matter because I have a choice of four plans and they're better plans. And I'm really happy because I've either signed up for a new plan or I am about to sign up for a new plan. And so the fact that my old clunky plan is getting canceled doesn't bother me. Well, the healthcare website has denied supporters of the president's plan those stories. But then the real worry is the policy impact of the fact that people aren't signing up. Now, they say in Massachusetts, people signed up late. The question is whether a sufficient number of people can sign up for non-Medicaid coverage, people who are young enough to work these pools out in the various regions in the country. And we won't know that until the middle of next year, probably.
Just a couple of weeks ago, we were having this conversation about the catastrophic fate that the Republican Party seemed to have consigned itself to. I cannot recall in my life a political situation turning around as rapidly and as comprehensively and as legitimately for legitimate reasons as this situation has. John, can you think of an example of, and is there any reason for the president to hope, oh, this is going to subside and everything will be back and people will remember how outrageously the Republicans behaved in September?
What was Clinton standing right before everybody learned about Monica? And
yeah, I was trying to remember whether the economy was doing well enough and the deficit was down and it all seemed hunky-dory. And
yeah,
then
I mean, now
yeah,
in the end,
okay.
Of course,
yes,
in the end,
okay, yeah.
Monica was not a fatal strike against the president. And so President Obama has seen his approval ratings in the Wall Street Journal poll are as low as they've been in his presidency. And his personal approval ratings, which used to be good even though his job performance numbers were bad, his personal performance numbers are now upside down for the first time, which just means more people don't like him than do like him. I think what's happened, David, is you have two things in decline. One is the Republican Party, and the other is the president. The president is in a slower rate of decline, but the Republican Party's decline still continues, and they still have all of the problems. Having said that, two things about this are good for Republicans. One, it takes this focus off of them. And two, on the Obamacare front, it allows some to say, well, you see, this is why we were really interested in Obamacare and why we wanted to stop it, because it has all these inherent flaws. That allows them to feel validated, but also more broadly, it allows them to say, you know, we're not only sort of soothsayers and we could predict all this in the future, but all of our 48 votes and everything, they weren't wasted effort because it's this been this bad. Now, whether that actually is the case doesn't really matter. It gives them an argument that they can sustain. Whereas before, people might have been like, you know, your obsession with healthcare over the Obamacare years after it had passed was kind of proof of the fact that you have no ideas and you're kind of off on these crusades and not doing anything that affects us and has anything to do with our lives.
Coming up, is it okay for private businesses to practice racial profiling? You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz, along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. So there's excitement in New York tabloids this week about the policing policies at two New York City department stores, Barney's and Macy's. Barney's in the midst of two lawsuits, or one lawsuit and one kind of incipient lawsuit, brought by black shoppers who said they were detained after shopping at their store in Manhattan. In one case, Trayon Christian, a 19-year-old man, had bought a Salvatore Salvatore Ferragamo. Salvatore Ferragamo? Salvatore Ferragamo?
You go for it, David. That sounds good enough.
Salvatore, we'll just say a Ferragamo belt.
Yeah, I think that's best. I leave all pronunciation
that's
up to
Emily. That's safer.
He bought a Ferragamo, a $350 Ferragamo belt with his Chase debit card on April 29th. He then says he was chased down on the street by plainclothes police officers several blocks away who said he couldn't possibly afford it to buy the belt and detained him. And
that the debit card had to be fake.
Yeah, and the debit card was fake, which is just crazy. So now he's suing both the city because it's police officers and then Barney's. So we have not really talked. We haven't talked about stop and frisk and about New York's racial profiling problem much on the show. I suspect we're all pretty leery of it to varying degrees. But I'm interested in particularly having a conversation with you, Emily, about when is it okay for a private business to engage in profiling practices? If a private business, the standards for a private business are different than they are for a public business. And is it okay for a private business to start singling out particular kinds of shoppers because they suspect them of theft or they don't want them in the store or whatever it is?
No, it's not okay. That's why when Macy's was accused of this a few years ago, the New York Attorney General investigated and they entered into a settlement in 2005. So it's true that private stores are not the government. It's not the same thing as the government engaging in racial profiling, but they are stores that are open to the public. They are not really private. And so for them to be doing this is illegal if that is indeed what's going on. I mean, we have to, you know, these lawsuits are at a very early stage. I don't think we know what this policy actually was. And there's a dispute between Barney's and the police department about who was doing what here. So I'm not so sure about the facts. But if they were indeed racial profiling in this way, they're going to be in trouble.
How much cause would they need to have to make it defensible? So, for example, they have records of people who have been either seen shoplifting or caught shoplifting, you know, with CCTV. And if they kept a record, they could say, well, you know, the profile of the person who shoplifts here is age X and racial profile X. And therefore, we're just following the science here of what we know about who takes things. And that's what led us to, you know, pay a little bit more attention to that kind of customer. Can they make that kind of defense?
If every single theft in Barney's was a young black male and you started profiling young black males, would that be okay? There's no way that is true, right? I mean, that's the problem with racial profiling is that it always
What if it was just young males? Let's take race out of the equation. What if it's just young males?
Then you're profiling on the basis of sex and age.
Yeah.
You know, when you have a protected category and age is not so much one, but gender is, and then you start treating people differently based on that category, you have to have an airtight, legitimate reason to do that. And I just cannot imagine that they would really have statistics showing that only young black men were stealing stuff from their stores. This is why stop and frisk fell apart for New York City in the lawsuit against New York City, because in fact, the statistics showed that it was certainly true that young black men were being disproportionately stopped, but they were not really committing the crimes that justified that extra attention. And that, I bet, is what the pattern would show in Barney's and Macy's too. We kind of want this to be some simple world, and it's just never really is.
No, I mean, I'm not that you went beyond the limits of my
question.
Which
I basically
just
rejected the hypothetical as being implausible.
You're not allowed to reject the hypothetical.
I'm not allowed to do that. So forget the legal question. I mean, let's just talk about this in policy terms. What would we want the rule to be? Like, if it turns out that there is a much higher risk of young men shoplifting, do you guys think that stores should be able to racial profile and follow them around and handcuff them?
Well, I actually think there are two separate issues here. I think there's a racial profiling issue, which is should they be able to, in the way that they monitor for loss, can they monitor and pay particular attention to young men? I think that's okay. The problem that I run into is where that moves into kind of the private army element. The thing that was so deplorable about the Macy's situation of a few years ago. Macy's basically was running a private prison.
Oh my God, it was amazing.
They handcuffed people, hold them
in cells, and forced them, kind of compelled them to pay fines on the spot.
Of course, but you assume part of that was just a deterrent, right? I mean, in other words, you make it hellish.
Right.
You got to get the word out, and then people don't steal from it.
Right. And, but I what alarms me about what's happened in this country is that there are now so many kind of quasi-police, quasi-military organizations. If you're a private, you know, if you think about like a company like Exxon, Exxon has a huge security apparatus. Any company has a huge security apparatus, and they accrue quasi-police powers. And what's alarming is when the private industry holds on to the police powers that truly belong to the state. So I don't mind the monitoring and the attention to particular groups as long as the actual enforcement and prosecution and authority remains with the state.
But wait a second. That is troubling to me. So
good.
So you're this guy who's bought this $350 belt. So say Barney's thinks that young black men steal their belts, and so they're going to watch him. And then he leaves the store, and in fact, this guy just bought the belt, so I can't really understand how he attracted the police's attention. But as long as then the Barney's employees call the NYPD instead of handcuffing him themselves, you're okay with them detaining someone for 2 hours who had a receipt and had a debit card? How is that okay?
I mean, that's bad, but I guess in that case, that's just bad work by Barney's. And by
well,
the
not
police.
Necessarily. I mean, someone thought this was like a fake card, I guess. I don't know. It's such a weird story. Like, I cannot imagine going into a store and buying something and having a receipt and having someone not believe me. But that's where we are. That's what this story sounds like it's about.
You know what's interesting? Sorry, just one thing that I was thinking about as I was thinking about this. Sometimes on occasion, very rarely actually, with sad rareness in my life, I will end up in a poor neighborhood in Washington or a poor neighborhood in New York and shop in a place when I might not otherwise shop, a bodega or a restaurant. And in a lot of poor neighborhoods, the assumption is of the criminality. The institution is designed around the criminality of customers, such that if you're in a liquor store in much of D.C., you can't, you know, you have bulletproof glass between you and whoever's serving you and between you and the money and you and the booze. Same at various kinds of fast food restaurants. And there's a stark dividing line. You know, if you're in a better off neighborhood, that the assumption, of course, is your customer is your client and your friend and so forth. But what's weird is that so many poor Americans live in a situation where they are constantly being treated as criminals when they shop to begin with.
But how does that fit with your previous point that monitoring everyone is just fine? I'm still confused.
My point here is just it's just a sad, terrible state where store owners feel they have to do this because they've had so much loss and theft, and so they behave in this horrible way toward those customers. But they behave in this horrible way kind of for justified reasons. Either they've been held up,
they've
been shot at.
But they're also treating everyone equally. Bulletproof glass does not distinguish between you, me, and a black person.
It seems to me that Macy's and Barney's have a lot of other remedies and a lot of other ways they could stop this from happening that don't require profiling. So, for example, on the credit card front, if you were worried about Chase debit cards being counterfeited, you know, you can call up Chase and say, hey, I got this Chase credit card. Is this really from you? And presumably, if there have been people been passing fake cards, you would have a legitimate reason based on merely the color of the card, not the color of the owner. So that's an easy remedy that doesn't require you to go chase the guy down the street. How do people shoplift? I thought things that like always had tags on them and everything, and those alarms are constantly and always going off. I mean, I guess it's a problem because both of these stores said they were losing lots of merchandise to theft. But my guess is that they haven't exhausted every other opportunity to stop shoplifting available. This is just kind of maybe a cheaper way to do it.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts right now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, we discuss the music and legacy of the great rock and roller Lou Reed. And then there's a Shakespeare glut these days, and we dipped in our cup and went to Broadway to see Orlando Bloom as Romeo. And finally, what is the internet doing to poetry? Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And, of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hello, Steve.
The rock musician Lou Reed died this past weekend at the age of 71, most likely from complications from a liver transplant he had back in May. He was, along with John Cale, of course, the founder of the rock group The Velvet Underground in the 1960s, after which he went on to have a long and varied and storied and quite remarkable solo career. It's almost impossible not to begin with Lou Reed by discussing his influence, which was felt immediately by David Bowie, Patti Smith, Brian Eno. They all understood that the Velvet Underground had done something astonishing, and they took it themselves and ran with it long after the group had disbanded. And what's flying around the internet, quite justifiably in the wake of Lou Reed's death, is the wonderful quote from Brian Eno, which is that only 30,000 people bought that first Velvet Underground album, but every one of them went and started a rock band of their own. I mean, you cannot exhaust the list of themselves extraordinary rock bands that completely owe their sound, their attitude towards the world, to Lou Reed. And every time a young person tries to make ambitious rock and roll, they are in one way or another channeling Lou Reed. And with that in mind, I turned to my co-host, Julia Turner, who sent me the most astonishing email. Julia, I'm not going to quote the email because I want you to be able to appear in public again going forward, but is it really possible that you only have a glancing acquaintance with the monument known as Lou Reed?
I have a gigantic Lou Reed-shaped hole in my musical education. I'm mortified to say that my first familiarity with the song Sweet Jane is because the Cowboy Junkies cover of it was on a mixtape made for me in middle school. So, no, I'm shamefully ignorant about Lou Reed, but I've enjoyed spending the past couple of days listening to his music. And, of course, I actually do know a ton of Velvet Underground and Lou Reed songs. It turns out I just never thought of him or considered him as a particular work. And I think one thing that's interesting coming to him late is he's one of those artists who's influenced so many people that it's hard to hear from here in the future just how revolutionary his sound felt and was when it first broke onto the scene.
To me, it just sounds like it was made yesterday. It's still so aggressive and odd. I mean, I understand that it's been assimilated into the musical vocabulary of, you know, all of rock and roll in a way, but I mean, with that as an intro, I think we should listen to something from that first album, like, you know, I'm Waiting for My Man is still just totally fresh to me and totally timeless. $6 in my hand. Up to Lexington, 125. Feel sick and dirty, more dead than alive. I'm waiting for my man.
So a couple things about Waiting for My Man that makes it a really good one to start with, I think. There are two chords, as far as I can tell, right? He just switches back and forth between two chords the whole time, which is very typical of this sort of non-virtuosic approach to rock and roll playing that he pretty much pioneered. So you kind of hear the seeds of punk right in there. Also, the subject matter, just so unusual for a pop song of that time, standing on a corner waiting for your heroin dealer. It has an honesty and a kind of grit that was nowhere in songwriting at the time.
I mean, the thing to remember about Lou Reed is that he was the son of an accountant from Long Island. He was very much a suburban kid. He knew it, and he fought against it, but I think he fought against it really honestly. He was, because he had displayed, you know, homosexual tendencies as a teenager, he was subjected by his parents to electroshock therapy and spent a lot of his life trying to wrest a sense of, you know, purpose, meaning, and beauty from a sense of degradation and deep depression and, you know, on and on. And that's kind of the theme that pervades his music, went completely against the tone and the ethos of the 1960s, which is one of the reasons why those records sold nothing at all. You know, he came by it honestly, and he stuck by it somewhat honestly, too. You know, on the kind of crazy live album he made in the late 70s called Take No Prisoners, he goes into these long Lenny Bruce-like monologues, in one of which he confesses that the reason he quit the Velvet Underground was that after the album Loaded, which has Sweet Jane and Rock and Roll on it, he sensed that they were about to break commercially, so he quit. His second solo album is produced by David Bowie, Transformers, truly one of the great rock and roll albums ever made. Has the song Walk on the Wild Side on it, which is his kind of hymn to all of the Andy Warhol superstars.
Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked away across USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way, shaved her legs, and then he was a she. She says, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side.
Improbably, that song becomes a hit song, gets tons of classic rock radio play, and Transformer becomes relatively kind of a hit record. And so what does he do? He makes Berlin, right, this super indulgent concept album about the divided city and drug addicts like crawling around the divided city of Berlin. And it really just has no commercial dimension to it whatsoever. And he did this again. He did it again. Rock and Roll Animal, the live album, has that live version of Sweet Jane that then gets tons of radio play. It's kind of a hit. And he makes Metal Machine Music, the single most unlistenable album, rock album ever made. I mean, it's just an insult to the years. I think, you know, we're going to talk about memes later in the show. I think that there's this really insidious meme out there, and I see it everywhere, which is that everyone secretly really wants commercial success, right? And anyone who's a holdout against it is somehow acting in bad faith or a poser. That it's not true. I think Lou Reed probably wanted to have a nice middle-class life, but there were certain things that he really did not want out of the music business, and he avoided them. And to my mind, he avoided them heroically.
Yeah, I think that's really right, Steve. I mean, he really conceived of himself as more than a rock and roll singer, more than a songwriter, that he was trying to connect rock with art in some way that it hadn't been before, whether it was kind of the literary influences of the poet Delmore Schwartz, who he studied with at Syracuse and who, you know, basically sort of reinvented his brain and became a huge mentor, and jazz and Ornette Coleman and just stuff that was not the influence of other 60s singer-songwriters at the time, not folk music and not even rock and roll except for those basic chords, but really something that was closer to like a conceptual art, which is, of course, explains his friendship and his longtime connection with Andy Warhol.
The one thing I would say, though, is like I can imagine what it's like for Julia to overhear this conversation, and she thinks, oh, yeah, conceptual art, more like conceptual art than music, more like, you know, Delmore Schwartz than, you know, like Beyonce or whatever. And I can just hear her going, check.
Well, I never said more like. I mean, I think those were influences that were percolating.
No, he was
every inch a songwriter. But Julia, I want to hear how all this is sounding to you. I mean, for myself, I mean, I think for Steve and I, this is so much a part of our kind of musical history that we can't imagine music without it. So to imagine that, you know, you're just sort of hearing these songs and judging them as songs, I'm curious to hear what you have to say.
They're beautiful. I mean, I didn't mean to belittle or dismiss Lou Reed or the Velvet Underground when I said that when you listen to them, it's hard to hear them fresh because you hear all the song, all their descendants in them. But for me, I think one thing that's surprising is the quickie stereotype of Lou Reed in my head, not having listened to him or ever thought about him particularly, is like, okay, heroin, deadpan drawl, Andy Warhol, banana cover, Nico, you know, it's sort of New York City. That's sort of like my Lou Reed word cloud prior to this weekend, I would say.
And Laurie Anderson. To me, the Lou Reed-Laurie Anderson couple is a big, big part of his history as
right,
well.
Right, right. But part of the power of the songs for me comes in the juxtaposition between those thorny, prickly, interesting lyrics and really beautiful, even though they're very simple, arrangements of music behind them. There's a real prettiness to the music itself that I hadn't really counted on, and that juxtaposed against his voice and his ideas is really powerful. You know, that I think about, I hear now in bands I grew up loving. I mean, I'm a huge Yola Tango devotee, and suddenly the whole of Yola Tango's work seems cast in a different light.
Yeah, Sonic Youth also completely unimaginable without Lou Reed, and cite him as a very direct influence, or R.E.M. or Roxy Music. I mean, I can hardly think of any.
I know, that's the thing, right? I mean, Stereolab, R.E.M., Nirvana.
Yeah, you know, I spent a lot of the 90s hanging around with musicians because I was dating an indie rock songwriter and hanging out with people from that kind of crowd. And Lou Reed was the one thing, if people were sort of getting together to jam, that everyone would know, almost more than the Beatles. If people were going to sit down and sort of like jam together and try to play a song everyone knew, it would be Sweet Jane, or it would be, I don't know, Venus in Furs or something. They would try to come up with a version of some Lou Reed song. And so I think of him as this kind of, yeah, there's just this kind of ur figure of people that are interested in songwriting but aren't virtuosic musicians and don't necessarily value being.
All right, well, moving on, we say goodbye to the, you know, truly great Lou Reed. He'll be sorely missed.
Just a perfect day. Drink sangria in the park.
Coming up, the hidden poetry of internet memes. You're listening to Gapfest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is Gapfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture Gapfest portion of the show. If you want to find links for the things that we mention on the program, we collect them on our show page, wnyc.org/gabfest. And please, if you would, leave a comment while you're there. Tell us what you think of us. That's wnyc.org/gabfest. All right. Well, there is a glut this season of Shakespeare productions going on, both in New York City and in the movie theater. There's Julie Taymor's version of A Midsummer Night's Dream. There's Stephen Fry and Richard III, and also, I think if I have this right, Twelfth Night. And then there's Ethan Hawke starring as Macbeth. We decided to go see the David Laveau production at the Richard Rogers Theater on Broadway of Romeo and Juliet. It stars Orlando Bloom and Condola Rashad as the star-crossed lovers. We haven't had a chance to talk to each other since we went and saw this. Julie, I'm really curious. What'd you think?
This was a preposterous production of Romeo and Juliet. It was very fun to see it with you guys because it was pretty bad, I thought. But it was also just fascinating to sit in a play and see Shakespeare with you guys and see who else was out to see Romeo and Juliet that night. A few incidental moments of ridiculosity that plagued this particular production of Romeo and Juliet. I will highlight the first is that Orlando Bloom rides a motorcycle onto the stage. Apparently, Romeo's entrance not sufficiently grand for a Broadway theater, so an actual motorcycle is ridden onto a relatively small Broadway stage, which left, instead of the impression of careening speed and wild abandon, the sense of like a kid on a tricycle kind of like tippy-toeing it around so that he wouldn't accidentally ride off stage or come careening into the orchestra. I did not think that worked well. There were also some, like, rods, some long rods resembling heat lamps that you'd find at an outdoor wedding that would light up at various times with big bars of flame just to highlight particular points in the sequence.
There was a lot going on that stage. I mean, you could not call it a minimalist production, even though, you know, it certainly wasn't realist. There wasn't furniture or anything like that. The stage looked sort of barren, but there, between the bell being raised and lowered and the tubes of fire and the motorcycles and the frescoes, there was a lot to look at.
Yeah, Dana, I take it from that response you didn't love this any more than Julia did.
Yeah, I just thought it was a jumble. It actually did have a couple good performances in it. And unfortunately, I don't think either really Romeo or Juliet was among them. I mean, Orlando Bloom and Condola Rashad, who's Felicia Rashad's, Mrs. Cosby's daughter, they got across the kind of freshness of the lovers. And, you know, they seemed happy to be hanging out on the balcony together. But they didn't really make the transition to tragedy in the second half, I didn't think. I thought the nurse was fantastic. Jane mm-hmm. Hunschell, yeah. I think, was her name. She's a Broadway veteran actress. And she brought a lot to that role. I love the role of Juliet's nurse anyway. It's kind of a great comic part that also has some real dramatic heft because, of course, she's the one who discovers Juliet fake dead.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I also loved the actor who played Mercutio. I mean, Mercutio is another classically great role in Romeo and Juliet because he gets all the great jokes off at the beginning. But it was an actor I wasn't familiar with. Christian Camargo, I think, was his name.
See, I thought he overacted a little bit.
Oh,
I mean,
really?
he had his whole sexual suggestiveness thing where he was constantly grabbing his crotch and thrusting it at people. And it was just kind of his only shtick.
You get enough of that here on the show? Yeah, I mean, I felt I have to chime in as kind of agreeing with the group. I mean, I felt often like I was eating at the most expensive restaurant in the Atlanta airport, you know? I felt like there was a lot of effort and kind of a little bit of scenery chewing and kind of fanciness. You know, a little Siegfried and Roy with the flame and the bell. It sort of presumed a level of boredom, incipient boredom.
Right, which is the worst. I hate that condescending presentation of Shakespeare. Like, yeah, we're going to jazz it up like it's not already interesting in the first place.
You know, the one distinction here is that the Capulets are all played by black actors, the Montagues by white ones. There's sort of a racial tension that goes largely unexplored.
Play does very, very little with that. It's actually strange that was the big concept that it was betting on because, you know, there's not really any kind of commentary embedded about contemporary race relations that I could see. And as far as just sort of putting Romeo and Juliet on different sides of a racial divide, I feel like West Side Story already did that very well 60 years ago.
Right. But can I also say, I think Romeo and Juliet is a particularly hard play to get right because I think it's by far not my favorite Shakespeare play, and I think it's a very flawed play. And can I lay out for you guys my beef with Romeo and Juliet, and you can just tell me I'm wrong and crazy?
Oh, my God. A crank theory is always encouraged.
Slate pitch away, Julia.
So I don't buy Romeo and Juliet as a love story. I mean, this is not a new point. People have made this point before, but the play takes great pains to make clear that Romeo was madly in love with Rosalind, this other woman, like up until the moment he meets Juliet, that he's mooning about. He's very susceptible to thinking that he's in love. There's so much attention in the text to how young they are, how little they know each other. It seems fairly silly when they drink themselves to death and stab themselves in that tomb and end up dead. And I feel like perhaps that's because Shakespeare was interested in the corrosive effects of the feud between the families more so than the love itself. I mean, I think the balcony scene is unimpeachable. It captures something about the feeling of a swoony love. But the story around that balcony scene of how overwrought it gets and how quickly it develops into just this inflated, tragic, poison-swallowing thing seems preposterous to me. Don't like the plot. Don't really like Romeo and Juliet.
Two thumbs down, Bill.
I wouldn't go that far.
No, I almost completely agree. It's not one of his better plays. And it's by the way, I think the critical consensus is totally 100% behind you on this. Not my favorite Shakespeare either.
Wait a second. Can I stand up for my man here for a second?
Oh, he's your man? Just because I don't like Romeo and Juliet, you get sick?
Well, I appear to be his partisan in this situation. I would just say that in addition to being about the feud between the Capulets and the Montagues and him having sort of a larger political interest than the love story, that it also is a play about the rashness of youth, precisely, and that silliness and impetuousness that gets Romeo and Juliet into this absurd situation where days after having met each other, you know, they're both dead from love for each other, is also sort of a critique of romantic love. I see that built into the play as well. I would also say that far more than the balcony scene, we've got, I mean, there's so many beautiful lyrical scenes between the two of them where I feel like at least the language of their love is incredible. The sonnet where they meet, I think that's my favorite part of the whole play. Mm. It's romantic and it's beautifully written, and I don't know. I mean, I'm going to stand up for Romeo and Juliet as maybe not one of Shakespeare's major, major plays, but a beautiful little gem for what it is and the perfect play to start out with.
Right. We should say it is still Shakespeare, right? I mean, and critics have also pointed out that as he goes along, Romeo gets better and better at formulating sonnets for Juliet. I mean, it's completely studded through with hidden and not so hidden gems, you know, including in the balcony scene where one of the major themes of the play really emerges in this heartbreaking way. If you know how the story ends, which almost everyone does.
I think we've spoiled it several times so far in this segment.
Furious listeners, how dare you?
But it's all
I haven't gotten to it yet.
A lot of the play is about how difficult it is for a young person to understand how embedded they are within highly complicated and overdetermined social relations, which they are very ready to reject, especially in the name of love, right? And so one of the things they're struggling with explicitly throughout the play is, what does it mean to be a Montague? What does it mean to be a Capulet? What are kinship relationships, familial relationships, household relationships, tribal relationships like, and what kind of a claim do they make on you? And they falsely argue. I mean, that's what's kind of great about the play, is they falsely argue that it doesn't mean anything. What's Montague? It's nor hand, nor foot, nor arm, nor face, nor any other part belonging to a man. Rose by any other name would smell as sweet. All of this turns out to be false in the play, which is why it's still Shakespeare, right? I mean, there's the skepticism and the acidness of Mercutio hangs over the entire play, which is why it's still a work of genius. It's still Shakespeare.
No, I think that's right. I mean, the play critiques it, but then that makes it an incredibly difficult play to perform because our heroes end up seeming a little bit like patsies. They're rash, and so we're supposed to feel a little bit superior to them, and they're trapped by circumstance in ways that they can't understand and struggle against.
All right, but just by way of last-ditch advocacy for William Shakespeare, I think we should go out on the hand sonnet, the dual sonnet that Romeo and Juliet speak upon meeting, because I actually think that contained within those 14 lines is the entire story of them falling in love, completely credible. So we have a clip of Orlando Bloom doing some Romeo and Juliet, but I think since we were all somewhat disappointed by his performance, we should try to do him one better and read a little Shakespeare ourselves.
Oh my gosh, Dana, I liked this idea, but now I'm looking at the text in front of me and feeling total Romeo and Juliet knock-kneed jitters. It's hard. It's hard to read these lines. If I profane with my unworthiest hand this holy shrine, the gentle fine is this. My lips, two blushing pilgrims, ready stand to smooth that rough touch with a tender kiss.
Good pilgrim, you do wrong your hand too much, which mannerly devotion shows in this. For saints have hands that pilgrims' hands do touch, and palm to palm is holy palmer's kiss.
Have not saints lips, and holy palmers too?
Aye, pilgrim, lips that they must use in prayer.
Oh, then, dear saint, let lips do what hands do. They pray, grant thou, lest faith turn to despair.
Saints do not move, though grant for prayer's sake.
Then move not, while my prayer's effect I take.
Smooch.
All right. Well, we went to see, as I said, the David Laveau production of Romeo and Juliet, starring Orlando Bloom and Condola Rashad. But more importantly, come to the Facebook page and tell us about, like, maybe landmark experiences you had seeing live Shakespeare. I've had many. I'm sure you have, too. We'd love to hear about yours. Okay, moving on. Imagine that the writer is a meme machine, writing works with the intention for them to ripple rapidly across networks, only to evaporate just as quickly as they appeared. So writes Kenneth Goldsmith in the New Yorker blog, arguing that poetry has radically adapted to the new medium of the internet. He goes on to say, imagine a poetry that is vast, instantaneous, horizontal, globally distributed, paper thin, and ultimately disposable. And he goes on to cite examples that may not strike you immediately as being poetry. There's a Nigerian email scammer who's writing out the entirety of Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets in longhand. There's a Moby Dick told entirely in emoticons. Ulysses as a barcode. And then there are examples of what you might call found poetry. I think Goldsmith does call them found poetry. Every tweet that has ever featured the word McNugget has been aggregated into a single document. And more provocatively, there's something called Kill List, which is a list of major living poets appended with their imagined class status. Dana, I will wring this around your neck until the day we're no longer doing the show, but you were once a graduate student, as was I, in literature. I'm curious whether you exited graduate school with a rigidly construed notion of what poetry is that would exclude some of these experiments, or whether, having read this essay, you find it convincing and that, in fact, this is what is replacing what we traditionally thought of, you know, sonnets, lyric poems, epic poems. This is what's replacing what we used to call poetry.
Yeah, I think the guy's basic argument that the internet is changing language in ways that redefine what poetry might be is a provocative avant-garde idea. I would say that the instances that he cites, like compiling every tweet mentioning a McNugget into a giant PDF that people can download, is I'm not sure that's going to take over as the next big poetic wave. But I do see those kind of linguistic practices happening in just more mundane places. On Twitter itself, the phenomenon of so-called weird Twitter, right? People who have these strange kind of out of left field, unpunctuated, reflective tweets that fly in from out of nowhere, and the whole kind of means by which that all scrolls by and is ephemeral and disappears. Certainly that has to be changing our poetic practices and our uses of language.
Right. I mean, if you even think about what the experience of reading Twitter is like, right? What happens in modern life that is more akin to reading poetry than reading Twitter, right? You're reading a series of lines that don't obviously run into one another necessarily, that end up juxtaposing language in unexpected ways.
That are compact,
that
compressed.
That are compact and compressed, that requires a concision of language. I mean, if you think of all of your Twitter feed as one long epic poem composed precisely for you, because only you probably follow the exact subset of Twitterers that you follow, and probably no one else in the world shares your exact experience of Twitter, you know, you could certainly theoretically conceive of Twitter as a gigantic personalized epic poem.
But the way in which this guy is claiming that these practices are going to replace poetry seems like it has just almost a purely provocateur stance. I mean, there's a whole thing about sort of let's compose poetry for robots. It actually has a sort of a Warholian kind of you tone, right? Like, let's compose poetry at a pure aggregation. It's essentially, there's a humanism buried in that anti-humanism. You see what I mean, Steve?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the force of the provocation derives from invoking this thing that people have a, in many instances, nostalgic attachment to, or kind of highbrow sentimentality about, right? So in this instance, poetry, and then saying its equivalent, contemporary equivalent, is this thing that you actually think of as inimical to that, and you do two things at once. You both throw into question people's sentimental attachment to the supposedly anachronistic thing. At the same time, you suddenly make people see in a new light something that they previously had thought was too pop, too disposable, too odd, too ephemeral. You suddenly see that in the light of older, more established, more seemingly permanent forms. I like that as a rhetorical exercise. I think, but if you have the courage to call something dead, then you don't need to import its prestige in order to ennoble this other thing in the present. The problem I had with this essay was, why would you ever bother, whatever the merits of these things are or aren't, why would you ever bother calling them poetry? What possible connection can you draw back from these gestures to words on a page in metrical form or free verse or whatever, but arranged with enormous care in order to produce meaning, right?
Right.
I mean, that to me is the essence of poetry. We might be done with it. It might be that the world is so forgetful and just screen distracted that, you know, John Donne or T.S. Eliot or their possible equivalents have no place in the modern world. But, you know, gut up on that argument and say it and then move on and say, well, you know, from ephemera we'll discover what meaning we can.
Right. I think that makes perfect sense, Steve. I mean, a lot of the experiments that he points to feel like literature, but not necessarily poetry. And in a way, I think he's using poetry as a sort of like the experimental subset of literature that fewer people read. It feels like he's using poetry to mean that rather than to actually mean words arranged with metrical care on a page. And, you know, he also, to be fair, draws some parallels to conceptual artists and people who are playing in mediums other than the strictly verbal, which seem possibly like fairer comparisons.
I think, I mean, he opens up an interesting question, maybe, but this to me functions more like a surrealist manifesto than to, and he does talk about Duchamp and so forth, than it does as any kind of outline for a coherent poetic practice. It's just sort of a bomb thrown into a library and then waiting to see what we'll all say.
All right, well, the piece is called The Writer as Meme Machine, How Has the Internet Altered Poetry? It's on the New Yorker website. It's by Kenneth Goldsmith. And we should say something we didn't point out in the body of our discussion is that he's riffing off of the ideas of a Canadian media scholar named Darren Werschler, who's been making these connections between memes and contemporary poetry. Thanks, Julia.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Dana.
Thank you, Steve.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, SoundCloud, or the newly updated WNYC iPhone app. Just search for Slate Gabfest. Gabfest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Sally Herships, Chris Wade, and Mike Vuolo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. And the executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone on the Gabfest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week. And Romeo wanted Juliet. And Juliet wanted Romeo. Romeo Rodriguez squares his shoulders and curses Jesus, runs a comb through his black ponytail. He's thinking of his lonely room, the sink that by his bed gives off a stink, then smells her perfume in his eyes, and her voice was like a bell.